today and then move on to other topics of differential geometry. Any questions or anything left over that you'd like to talk about before we get started? Yeah, the only danger is that I might get hungry and then I'll make a grab for it. Okay, so let's go back to what we were talking about, which was the topic of Lie differentiation. And what I want to do is to, well, just, you know, tell you what the bottom line was, the punchline was last time. Remember, we had introduced this, this network of curves to which U is tangent. So here's U on one of the curves, and U is, defined away from the curve, and we have not just a tangent vector on one curve, but a tangent vector field on a bunch of curves. And what we wanted to do is to compare the vector A at one point to another vector A at some other point. And we wanted to do that, so this would be the point P, this would be the point Q. We have the vector field A at P, the vector field A at Q, and the whole thing was about trying to compare those two vectors in an appropriate way, an appropriate tensorial way, because we're not allowed, tensorially speaking, to compare the two vectors directly. We have to find a way of bringing the vectors at the same point. And, one way of doing this is through covariant differentiation, where you introduce a connection, which is an extra rule that allows you to do this transport of the vector from one point to another. But for Lie differentiation, instead, I went through the whole construction last time where, I was constructing cross curves and, carrying them out rigidly and so on. And we found a way of actually comparing the vectors directly through this rather elaborate construction. But, in the end, we end up with the notion of derivative that does not require, a connection, something that can be defined primitively without extra structure on the manifold. And the expression that we ended up with for the Lie derivative of the vector A along U, along the curve to which U is tangent, involves the derivative of the vector along U, and with the minus sign, the derivative of the vector U along A. And that's an operation that's defined only if you can differentiate U away from the curve, because the direction of the vector A does not have to be the direction of the curve itself. And that means that you have to be able to differentiate the vector field U in directions away from the curve. And that means that, of course, the vector field has to be, defined not just on one curve, but, elsewhere. And that means that if you insist that U will be tangent to curves, that means that, well, you have one curve, but you have also another bunch of curves that allow you to define these things. But that's the notion of a covariant derivative, Lie derivative, and it involves only partial differentiation, but combined in such a way that the operation is actually tensorial. And in fact, what you could do is to rewrite the Lie derivative in terms of covariant derivatives by just replacing the ordinary differentiations by covariant differentiations. And the advantage of expressing it in the first form is that, well, here it makes it obvious that you can define the Lie derivative without reference to a connection. So it's an operation that is more primitive than covariant differentiation. But here you might get worried that the operation is not properly tensorial, because individually here each term does not transform as a tensor. However, in the packaging that we have, including the minus sign, the left-hand side is something that will transform as a tensor. That is made obvious here. Here we express the, the tensor on the left-hand side in terms of, the difference between two tensors. So here we have an obvious tensorial property for each term, but here we're hiding the fact that the operation, in fact, is more primitive than covariant differentiation. Here we seem to demand the existence of a connection, but it's really not necessary. And the point, of course, is that the difference between the second line and the first line involves two Christoffel symbol terms that cancel out because of that minus sign. So that's where we were at. And what I'm going to do is to continue this and extend the definition of the covariant derivative, Lie derivative, to dual vectors and then tensors, And well, the way of doing that is just to demand that the operator, the potential operator, the lead derivative operator, satisfy the usual product rule of calculus. So I see that you're with us at McMaster, so can you see and hear properly? And let's see, I think if I do something here, I'll be able to hear you as well. I don't see what I need to do, so audio control, help. Can you say something now? I know there's something that can be done about this, but offhand I don't know what to do. So, well, anyway, so for the time being, I can't hear you from Mac. Okay, so let's take it from here. So what I want to do is to extend the definition to dual vectors. And the idea is to just, you know, do it, you know, figure it out by demanding that no, I can't hear them from Mac. And I know there's some buttons that need to be pressed here. But that one here? Oh, I've been doing that. Maybe I didn't crank it up right enough. Can you try again? Okay, we're still unable to hear you, so, well, sorry about that. We have someone working on it. Okay, so so first of all, so to extend the operation to other types of tensors, the first thing I'm going to say is that if we're dealing with a scalar, of course, the lead derivative operator will just reduce to ordinary differentiation along the curve. So we're still differentiating along the direction of a vector u, but for scalars, there's no difficulties because, you know, we can always compare two scalars at different points. There's no problem in doing that. So now the question is, how are we supposed to define the operation of lead differentiation on a dual vector? Well, the idea here is to just to figure it out by combining this dual vector with a vector, combining the two in a scalar quantity, and then just work it out. And the key property is that we're going to demand that that the operator satisfies the product rule. So the statement number one is that, well, we demand that the lead derivative operator satisfies the product rule. So this is something we also demanded of covariant differentiation, and I think any decent derivative operator will be forced, will be always satisfying that rule. So how do we go about this? Well, I'll just go through the steps just to, you know, be explicit about it, but it's really very simple. So first of all, we say that if I combine a dual vector with a vector, and I take the lead derivative of this, well, first of all, it's going to be the lead derivative of the scalar, and we know how to deal with that. So to begin with, it's just going to be the scalar differentiated in the direction of the vector u. And, well, the ordinary derivative, of course, satisfies the product rule. So to begin with, we have this, where we first differentiate p, and then we differentiate a. So that's the first statement. And the second statement is that, well, the operation has to satisfy the product rule, which means that what we're going to have is, first of all, the derivative operator acting only on p, leaving a alone, and then p will be left alone, and the lead derivative operator is going to be acting on a. And we know what that is, so we just make the substitution and solve for the quantity that interests us. So if I work it out, then I'm going to isolate this term on the left-hand side on, so I'm going to throw this over to the right-hand side. I'm going to make explicitly what it stands for. And then I'm going to subtract this, but we know what this is. It's going to be plus, so there's an overall minus sign here because I've thrown that away to the other side. And the lead derivative of A is A alpha comma beta u beta minus u alpha comma beta a beta. So if I didn't make any mistakes, we should see some cancellations taking place. And sure enough, we see that that term cancels out with this term, and we're left with two terms. And the terms that are left out are each proportional to A. And what I'm going to do is to just play around with dummy indices to clean this up a little bit. So let me just write it in two sets of steps. And now it becomes just a simple exercise in index algebra. So we have that. We have the derivative of u in the direction of a. Notice that now I have a plus sign. So all I'm going to do here, I have two dummy indices, alpha that's summed over, beta that's summed over, and I'm just going to switch them. I can do that because they're dummy indices. There's no harm done. But the reason why I'm doing this is because I want to factorize the A alpha that's going to be common to each term. So if I do that, I'm going to have for the first term the derivative of P in the direction of U, and then I'm going to have P beta times the derivative of U beta comp alpha, all of that multiplying A alpha. And the point here is that the vector A is completely arbitrary. This is an identity that must hold for all possible vectors A, and therefore we can conclude from this that we can just remove the factors of A alpha. The expression for the lead derivative actually only appears, only can be identified by. So the point, of course, is that A is arbitrary, and that's why I can actually cancel it out in that equation. If A were a specific vector field, I would be able to make that step. So bottom line here is, after being done with this little computation, we have an expression for a lead derivative acting on the dual vector, which now involves the sum of two terms instead of the difference. And that's what we end up with. And here also, I can leave it in that form and emphasize the fact that we don't need a connection to define this. Or I can re-express everything in terms of covariant derivatives. To emphasize that the operation is actually properly tensorial. Each expression is equivalent to the other. And here we get a cancellation because the Christoffel term that we generate here comes with a minus sign, while the Christoffel term we generate from here comes with a plus sign. So we still have that cancellation of Christoffel terms. And if you don't believe me, you can just work it out for yourself. So that's how we define the lead derivative of the dual vector. And once we have that, we just continue the game, and we can extend the definition to an arbitrary tensor. And for example, I can just write down the expression that would be valid for a tensor of rank 2, for example, if I had the lead derivative acting on tensor with all the indices down. I would get something like this. I would get the derivative of the tensor in the direction of u. And then I have two additional terms that would both come with a plus sign. And the way it works out is that, well, you just sort of mimic what's happened here. Here we need to differentiate the vector u, and we have summation over the index that comes with a tensor. Here we're going to do that. We're going to do that twice because we have two indices to worry about. So the first thing that we do is that, well, I'm going to differentiate the vector u, so there's going to be a summation index associated with that, so I'll call it gamma. And there's going to be a derivative index that will match the first of those two indices. And then we're going to have the tensor for which the first index has been replaced by the summation index, and the second index is left, to what it was. And then we have another term where u is differentiated with respect to the second index. And now the tensor is, you leave the first index alone and you replace the second index by the summation index. So the only thing you need to worry about here is whether it's a plus sign or a minus sign. what happens to the indices pretty much takes care of itself. So you just make sure that the indices are balanced, you know, that the summation indices are upstairs and downstairs, and you just, you know, are careful in balancing the position of the indices. And the only thing you need to know is that if the indices are both down, you get two plus signs. If you have mixed indices, you'll get a plus sign for each down index and a minus sign for each plus index. You have a question?
First term, gamma.
The index?
No, on the first term. The first term.
Oh, sorry, yes.
Very good. That was deliberate. To make sure you were paying attention.
Okay, so you just keep on going like this, and then you can do it with all the indices up, and you have, you know, minus signs, and, you know, I think in the notes I list a few other possibilities. But the point is that all those rules are justified by making repeated use of the fact that the derivative operator satisfies the product rule. So if you establish that, what I would do is to multiply this by two vectors, A, alpha, B, beta, and work that out. And you know, do all the cancellation stuff. So just repeat the steps here, but it would be a little bit longer. And but you know, that's where I would end up being. So you can just systematically do that, and then the recipe becomes you know, very clear. So now the question I want to turn to is, well, what is useful about this? Well, by the way, I can also rewrite this in terms of. So you just replace all the derivative operators by covariant derivative operators, and again, if you work it all out, you'll find that all the self-simple terms that rise cancel out, so that here you have tensorial expression, here you have the expression that tells you that the operation is more primitive than covariant differentiation. So the question I want to turn to now is, you know, what is the usefulness of the derivative? So it's nice that from differential geometry it's a cooperation, but you know, given that in GR we do have a connection, perhaps we don't care so much about that. But in fact, the derivative operator is really very useful, something that I told you, I think, last time a little bit about. It's really the derivative operator that tells you how to formulate a statement of invariance under a symmetric transformation. And that's why it's useful. And I just want to look at this in the context of a very, you know, specific example. So suppose that I want to express the fact that, you know, I have a metric for a given space-time and that the metric is actually invariant under time translation. So the metric doesn't depend on time, and I don't care whether the time is, you know, 10 past 10 to 11 or, you know, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. The metric looks the same at all times, therefore the metric is time invariant. And in fancier language that I'll come back to later on in this course, I'm talking here about a stationary space. So an example of, you know, a time-independent metric is the Schwarzschild metric. So you all know the Schwarzschild metric. The metric coefficients depend on R, they depend on, you know, theta, but they don't depend on time. So that's a clear example. So how do I express this? Well, in sort of elementary ways, you can say that the metric won't depend on time if the partial derivative of the metric tensor with respect to time is zero. And that's a very fine way of saying that the metric doesn't depend on time, but one thing that this implies is the fact that you've identified a coordinate system such that time is sort of singled out in a meaningful preferred way because it's with respect to that time that the metric is time independent. So the Schwarzschild metric, when you express it in terms of time as measured at infinity, is time dependent. But if you were a free-falling observer falling toward the black hole and used your own proper time to express the metric, well, you would find that, in fact, the metric is not time dependent because according to your own time and according to your own perception, gravity is getting stronger as you're approaching the black hole. Therefore, according to your own time, the metric does seem to depend on time. So, you know, what do we mean by time independent? Here I've made selection of what I mean by time, and it's with respect to that time that metric is time independent. So the point here is that, well, we, you know, we have a way of saying this that relies on the existence of a preferred coordinate system. And in GR and differential geometry in general, it's always good to find ways of saying this without appealing to preferred coordinates. And that's where the Lie derivative comes in. Let's work out what the Lie derivative is if we're actually acting on the metric. If I take a special tensor, which is not some arbitrary tensor T alpha beta, but if I pick the metric instead, this equation will simplify, because one property that the metric has is that its covariant derivative is zero. That's the statement that essentially picks up the connection for us. So if I look at the second line and I apply it to the metric, I get zero from this term. And here I can use the metric to lower the indices, because the operation of lowering indices and taking covariant derivatives commutes. And that all comes from the fact that covariant derivative of the metric is zero. So if I specialize this result to the metric tensor itself, I get this expression right here. So here I'm using the metric to lower the index. So on the first term, I get beta semicolon alpha, and for the second term, I get that term right here. So the Lie derivative of the metric along the vector u involves just derivatives of the u vector in this symmetrized combination. Okay, that's the side calculation I wanted to do. And I'll return to that in just a second. What I'm trying to do here is to find a better way of expressing this in a coordinate invariant manner. And the bottom line is going to be that I can say all of this in terms of the Lie derivative. And the statement that I'm going to make in the end is that the Lie derivative of the metric along a vector pointing in the direction of the time symmetry is going to be zero. So that's where I want to get go. So, well, let's go back to that picture right here where we have a favorite time coordinate. And if we have a favorite time coordinate, that means that we can draw curves of constant spatial coordinates along which time is running. So the preferred time coordinate gives me a sequence of curves. It gives me that network of curves that I needed in order to define covariant derivative, the Lie derivative. So those are all curves of constant spatial coordinates. And on these curves, the only thing that changes is time. So time is a parameter that runs along each curve. And those curves are important curves because those are the curves along which we have the symmetry transformation. What I know is that if I evaluate the metric at this point in the curve, and if I evaluate it again here or here, I get exactly the same value, because that's what it means really to have time translation invariance. So the statement of time translation invariance can be stated that way, or it can be stated in a more sophisticated way by just saying that we have this congruence of curves, this network of curves, and the metric does not change if I move along the curves. But now we're getting closer to the better differential geometry way of describing things. And if we have the curves, perhaps we can describe the curves in a way that's coordinate invariant. And that's where we're going to be led toward the Lie derivative picture. So we have the curves, and those are the symmetry transformation curves. And if we have curves, we have a tangent vector to the curve, and the tangent vector for the time being I'll call u. And here we have a vector field that is defined throughout space-time, and if I move along, in the direction of that vector field, I move along the direction of time symmetry. In the preferred coordinate system, which will involve t and some spatial coordinates that I didn't care to to describe in any detail. The curves are curves of constant spatial coordinates. T runs along the curve, which means that the tangent vector in that spatial coordinate system is purely along the time direction. So if I were to describe the tangent vector in this coordinate system, it would have a component along the time direction, which just would be 1. Because T is adopted as the parameter along the curve, so D coordinate with respect to D parameter is 1, and it would be 0 here, 0 here, and 0 here. So we're not moving the spatial direction, only moving the time direction. U alpha is defined to be, dx alpha dt, and in components in that preferred coordinate system, we have that. And the important point here is that, again, in the preferred coordinate system, the components are constant, which means that in that coordinate system, again, we have that. In the notes, I try to be careful about writing an equation like this, because this is an equation that's not tensorial, and it's an equation that's valid only in one particular coordinate system. So what I like to do is to indicate the preferred nature of coordinates by putting some specificity sign along with the equality sign so that we recognize, or we are warned the fact that this is a statement that's only valid in one specific coordinate system. So that's true here, and it was also true here. All right. Well, what's the lead derivative of the metric in general terms? The lead derivative of the metric, if I keep everything in terms of fourth degree derivatives, well, we have the expression over here. First of all, we have the derivative of the metric along the direction of u. And then we have derivatives of u, for example, u gamma comma alpha times the metric plus another term like this. And now we're getting near to where we want to be, because this term in that coordinate system is 0. The next term is also 0, because the derivatives of u are 0 in that coordinate system. In the preferred coordinate system, this is the derivative of the metric in the direction of the vector field u. That's what we've meant all along by the time derivative of the metric. And now we're going to make a step that's actually beautiful and, central to a lot of derivations in GR or differential geometry. We worked out an expression for a tensor in a particular coordinate system. And in that particular coordinate system, we've concluded that the tensor is 0. A tensor is a tensor. A tensor that's 0 in one coordinate system is guaranteed to be 0 in all coordinate systems. And now we have a statement about the metric, which can be written in any coordinate system. So in any coordinate system, you can locate the curves of time translation symmetry. And they can be very complicated if the coordinate system is not well adapted to that symmetry. But the curves exist anyway. And the statement is that if you have the time symmetry invariance for the metric, the lead derivative of that metric is going to be 0. And that's a statement that can be made in any coordinate system. So we've established the fact that the tensor is 0 in one preferred coordinate system, but given that we're dealing with the tensor, if it's 0 here, it's going to be 0 in any coordinate system. That's a step that allows you to do all sorts of computations very easily, because sometimes it's useful to introduce a preferred coordinate system to do a computation, and if you conclude that tensor is equal to another tensor in a specialized coordinate system, the tensorial nature of the equality guarantees that the equality has to be true for any coordinate system. And, that allows, there are lots of ways, there's going to be times where we use that fact to our benefit. Okay, so the bottom line of all this is that now we have a better statement of time translation symmetry. If the metric is invariant under a translation. Along curves to which u is tangent, is tangent, then we have time translation symmetry. And the proper way of expressing this mathematically in a coordinate invariant language is that the lead derivative of the metric along those curves, along the vector field tangent to those curves, is zero. Here I've done it for the metric, but I could have done it for any other tensor, and the statement would have been exactly the same. So if for any given tensor you find that this tensor is invariant, if you translate in some particular direction, then if you identify the curves along which you have symmetry, by exactly the same calculation, you will conclude that the lead derivative of that tensor, whatever it is, would be zero.
The time
bunch,
is that right?
No, that's true. So here again, I was using the time like base as just an example, but this would hold in any symmetry transformation. So typically in GR, there are two symmetries that we always, that we tend to focus on. One is the time translation symmetry for stationary space times. Then there's the rotational symmetry of axisymmetric space times. And then there are more complicated symmetries that are also in the picture, for example,
the boost symmetry of the Sitter space, for example, things like that. So there are lots of different possible types of transformations that give rise to a symmetry. For all of them, there's a vector field that generates that symmetry, and that symmetry is stated by the fact that the lead derivative of the tensor, but here the metric, is zero. So that's why the lead derivative is very useful, because it's really the proper way of expressing invariance under symmetry transformation, something that the covariant derivative itself, doesn't know about. The lead derivative incorporates that information. So it's the lead derivative that really carries that information about symmetry invariance when you have it. When you have that, U is called by a very special name. It's called Killing tensor by the name of some famous mathematician called Killing. So it's Killing with capital K. And, when the tensor that possesses the symmetry is the metric, the tensor field, the vector field along which you have the symmetry is called the Killing vector. So when we have that symmetry, then in this case, U is the Killing tensor, Killing vector, I should say. And one way of recognizing that a given vector field is a Killing vector is to just to make use of that equation right here that tells us that if the covariant derivative of the tensor field is an antisymmetric tensor, it has no symmetrized part, then you have a Killing vector. So the way to test whether or not the vector is Killing is to check that the property is satisfied, and that means that the tensor that you construct by taking the covariant derivative of the vector field is antisymmetric. Because this is the statement that says that the symmetric part of that tensor vanishes, what's left over has to be an antisymmetric tensor, and that's how you recognize it. So, there's some applied mathematicians over the last century who have made their careers out of trying to classify all possible symmetries of, space times and things like that. And, step number one is to try to solve that equation and, and sort of incorporate that information into expression for the metric. So there's a lot that's known about classifying space times under symmetry transformations. There's a book, Exact Solutions, that's about this thick, that contains, thousands and thousands, if not billions, of exact solutions to the Einstein field equations. Most of them completely useless from a physics point of view, but nevertheless, they're exact solutions anyway. And the way that the book is organized is through this, the action of the metric under symmetry groups, so you classify the metric under how many transformations, how many symmetry properties they have. And so, you know, from an applied mathematics point of view, those features, those symmetries, are extremely important in trying to find exact solutions. So, and that's, you know, that's not, you know, unusual, because that's not strange, because, you know, you remember in the previous course when you first derived the Schwarzschild metric, well, the first step is to say, okay, let's write down a metric that has the property of being time invariant. Let's write down a metric that has the property of being spherically symmetric. You use those symmetry properties to simplify the form of the metric to the largest extent possible, and then you end up with a rather simple task of solving the field equations for the few remaining functions that, you know, that remain within the metric. So the symmetry group is actually very important, and that's the sort of formal state of all of this in terms of proper differential geometry. Any questions about that?
Mm-hmm. In fact, that curve, the new time, the new time transformation, why we say that curve is stationary in space time?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because so the question said, you know, if we know that for Schwarzschild black hole, when we go inside the event horizon,
well, what do you mean by time, what do you mean by space seems to change a little bit. And when we move inside the black hole, we're forced to move inward, because, you know, the R coordinate has become time-like coordinate, the old time coordinate, T, has become spatial coordinate. So so inside the black hole, we don't seem to have that time invariance property that we have outside, and that's actually correct. So what happens, though, is that, you know, the secret, so we have the symmetry on the translations along the T direction, regardless of where we are in the spacetime. The interpretation of that changes, but the statement that we do have that symmetry does not change. So outside the black hole, the time translation symmetry, or the T translation symmetry, is time translation. Inside the black hole, we still have T coordinate that doesn't appear in the metric. Motion along the T direction is no longer time-like motion, it's become space-like motion. So we still have symmetry property, but the signature, or the, you know, the signature of that symmetry has changed from being time-like to being space-like. So we still have the symmetry, but the interpretation of it is different, and certainly we should probably not call it a time translation symmetry inside the black hole. Other questions? Okay, so let me just say a few more things about this and bring a connection with the geodesic equation, because an important aspect of having Killing vectors in our space-time is the fact that to each one, we have conserved quantities if we have geodesic motion, and that's also a very important feature. So symmetries are good. They bring out all sorts of simplifications, and that's why we like them. And that's why most of the, you know, known solutions to Einstein's field equations are, you know, heavy with symmetries, because otherwise they would be very difficult to identify. So normally, Killing vectors are given a special notation instead of U, which would be standard tangent vector. And in fact, now I'll start using U as the four velocity vector, so I'll change the notation. Typically, the Killing vector is going to be denoted with the Greek letter C. And the defining property then is that the lead derivative of the metric along C is going to be zero, and that means that the symmetrized covariant derivative of that vector is going to be zero. And any given spacetime can have any number of Killing vectors up to a magic maximum number, which is what? 10. So 10 is the ultimate number to which, you know, of Killing vectors you can have. And there's, I think, only one spacetime, except for topological identifications, that has the maximum number of killing vectors in that specific space zone. And essentially, you have a bunch of killing vectors. You have three that correspond to space translations. You have three that corresponds to boosts, and then three others that correspond to rotations, and then there's one more that I don't know. Or time translation. Yeah, four translations, three rotations, three boosts. So that's all you can do. So Minkowski spacetime has all that. Sidra spacetime has all that. But those are spacetimes that are loaded with symmetries. Typically have a much smaller number. Okay, so we have that killing vector, and what I'm going to introduce here is, a curve that I'll take to be a dudesic. So I like to call my curves gamma. Now the tangent vector to the curve I'm going to call u, but it's a different u from what I was talking about before. So u is going to be the tangent to the curve. So we have dudesic gamma with tangent or velocity vector u, and I'm certainly not assuming that u is a killing vector. I should have adapted my notation before. And for the purposes of this discussion, I'm going to assume that we have defined parameterization for our geodesic. So the geodesic is actually an affinely parameterized. Which means that if it's a time-like geodesic, which I'll assume, I'm using proper time as a parameter. But here I could be dealing with null geodesics, which means I would be dealing with null geodesic that is a finely parameterized. Or I could be talking about space-like geodesics. It really makes no difference. But it's important to generate the constant of the motion that we do have a fine parameterization. So what I want to show is that if we construct a quantity, I'm not sure what I'll call it k, I want to prove that k, defined to be the contraction between the four velocity and killing vector, I want to prove that this is the constant of the motion. And that will follow from the fact that u satisfies the GD's equation, and c is a killing vector. I need both ingredients to prove the result. So the proof, well, actually, is very simple. We just calculate the rate of change of k along the word line, and we see what happens. So we calculate dk d tau. And we just work it out. So here I express my derivative as an ordinary derivative because I'm differentiating the scalar field along the curve. So I don't need to worry about which kind of derivative I'm talking about. But k stands for a contraction of, how do I write it here, of vector and another vector. And here, if I want to use the product rule, I have to be careful with how I express my derivative. So the first thing that I'll do is to re-express this ordinary derivative as a covariant derivative acting on the same scale. And here, there's no distinction because I'm differentiating a scale. But now I'm going to use the product rule, which means that here, I'm going to be using the covariant derivative operator on each one of those tensorial quantities. So we keep going. We end up with the derivative operator acting on u, and we leave c alone. And then we have u, and now we have the derivative operator acting on c alone. Well, the first term goes away because, as we decided, this is a geodesic that's defined parameterized, and therefore the absolute derivative or the covariant derivative of the velocity vector is zero. So we don't have to worry about the first term. The second term, I'm going to write it in full. So we have u alpha. We have the covariant derivative of c in the direction of u. And I'm going to just rewrite it in this form right here. And last, if it's trivial, I'm going to work it out in detail so that you, you know, if you haven't encountered that index gymnastics before, you can see it, but this is a step that normally I would take automatically. I would recognize that this is a symmetric tensor, because if I interchange alpha and beta, I'm not changing that. But here I have an anti-symmetric tensor, because C is a Killing vector, because if I were to interchange alpha and beta here, I would get my sign by virtue of the Killing equation. And anytime you multiply an anti-symmetric tensor to a symmetric tensor, you're guaranteed to get zero. And that's the statement of conservation. So let me just work this in full, just so that, you know, there's no mystery about this. When I have an expression like this, I have two different dummy indices, alpha and beta, and I can always relabel those indices without doing any harm. So one way that we can, so I can rewrite this expression, first of all, as half of itself plus another half of itself. But in the second half, what I can do is to relabel, you know, switch alpha and beta around. So I can call alpha beta, and I can call beta alpha, and I'm still summing over those indices. It's still a dummy index, so I'm not changing the meaning of the operation. So I do that. What do I have? Well, now I can factorize. I have a factor of 1/2. Now I have the factor that we recognize is explicitly zero by virtue of Killing's equation. And those two factors, well, they're symmetric, right? It doesn't matter whether I invert this product or invert that product. You know, we're talking about the same thing, so I might as well just rewrite it in this form right here. And that's what I was talking about. This being zero, the symmetric part of that being zero by virtue of Killing's equation means that, well, that the result is zero. Another way of saying it is the way I said before. Here we have symmetric tensor. Whenever we multiply an arbitrary tensor to a symmetric tensor, only the symmetrized part matters. And if the symmetric part is zero, then you get zero. Another way of saying that is just to say that, well, if this is known to be anti-symmetric, and this is multiplying symmetric tensor, again, by exactly the same reason, you get zero result. And that's, you know, that's a trick. That's something that, you know, as you get used to doing these kinds of calculations, you have to spot right away, because that will save you a lot of trouble in the end. Okay, so bottom line is that if you have space-time with a symmetry, if you have the Killing vector all worked out, whenever you have geodesic motion, you have constant of the motion. The importance of time parameterization comes from the fact that if we did have it, this term can go away. And we would have a term here that would be proportional to you. And if we have that, you can work it out in your head. You would have a statement that the derivative of k with respect to tau would be proportional to the contraction of u and c, which is k itself. In that case, when you don't use a time parameterization, you have dk d tau to be proportional to k. And it means that k would vary exponentially with the parameter. So that's still sort of a state of symmetry, but not quite as useful. Symmetry appears to be hidden here, and conserved quantity is also a little bit hidden. So to really take advantage of the symmetry, it's a good idea to have a finite parameterization. Sometimes the disadvantages of dealing with a finite parameterization outweigh the advantages. So, you know, you have to decide which is best. But normally, when you want to exploit the conserved quantities, you have to use a finite parameterization. Okay. So, well, an example, of course, is the Schwarzschild metric. So we can look at a very specific example. So for the Schwarzschild metric, for example, we have, well, the usual thing. I like to write in this form. where F is the well-known 1 minus 2 M over R in units where G and C are equal to 1. D omega is standard notation for the metric on the unit 2 sphere. And when we write the Schwarzschild metric in this form, we see right away that, first of all, the metric doesn't involve time, so we have time translation symmetry. And we see also in metric coefficients that there's no phi dependence. So the Schwarzschild metric is actually symmetric. What is less obvious, but, you know, is associated with the fact that this is the metric on the unit 2 sphere, is the fact that we have, in fact, not just axis symmetry, but complete spherical symmetry over the whole sphere. And there are a couple, so there are a couple more Killing vectors associated with that. So we have one Killing vector associated with time, one Killing vector associated with rotational symmetry, and two more associated with the full spherical symmetry of the space-time. And in the notes, I actually tell you what those Killing vectors are. But the easy ones to spot is, the time-like Killing vector, which is the one that only has the time-like component. And we have the rotational one, which only has components along the phi direction. And given that we have them, we're guaranteed to have two constants of the motion when we look at the geodesic motion in Schwarzschild. So if we have geodesic motion in Schwarzschild, and we generically express the four velocity in this form right here, then we can identify the two constants of the motion. There's going to be one associated with the time translation invariance, which you would call the energy, because energy is that quantity that's conserved on the time translation invariance. And here, to make the sign come out right, we would actually define the energy to be that quantity right here. So I modify the sign, that doesn't change the fact that we have conserved quantity, but that makes the energy positive. And let's work out those components. So if I use the metric to lower the index, when I lower the index of the time entry, I get a factor of minus F. When I lower the index here, I get an F minus 1. And here I get a 1 for R squared. And over here, I get R minus squared sine minus, that's really 1 for R squared sine squared theta times phi dot. So that's what happens when I lower the index using the metric. And here, we have minus sine that's compensated here. When I do the summation here, I only pick that. So if this is the time translation Killing vector, there's only one component, the UT component, and that tells me that T dot over F, if I move along the geodesic in Schwarzschild space-time, that will be a conserved quantity. Very useful thing. And then, of course, we have the angular momentum, which is going to be the contraction of four velocity with the rotational Killing vector. That would be the angular momentum along the Z direction, so it would be the Z component of the angular momentum vector. And in this case, we just read it off from here. This only has a phi component, and the expression for the angular momentum vector. Yeah, what have I done here? I've used the inverse metric here. That was very silly. So I'm using the metric, not the inverse metric. So this is R squared theta dot. This is R squared sine squared theta phi dot. And the expression for the angular momentum now makes more sense. We've got R squared sine squared theta times phi dot. Normally in Schwarzschild, we take advantage of the full spherical symmetry to work in the equatorial plane, so we can set this equal to 1. And that's the usual expression for the angular momentum conserved quantity. So essentially that all follows from the Killing symmetry, two obvious Killing symmetries of the Schwarzschild space. Yep.
Thanks, Gabriel. Steven, looking at that.
just bring it to the line above top for it. Well, I see it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there are those cues.
Sort of made use of last time is the FRW spacetime. So if you have an expanding universe and the metric is something like this, and I'll take here just for simplicity the spatially flat case, then, well, here we don't have time translation symmetry because the universe is expanding. The universe later on looks different from the universe before, but we have a metric that is spatially homogeneous, which means that we have three killing vectors pointing in the direction of x, y, and z as spatial translation symmetries. So the homogeneity of the space time guarantees the existence of three killing vectors in the spatial directions. And here, well, you know, the algebra of the killing vectors is such that the spatial sections are flat. But you can have homogeneous spacetime with, you know, curved, you know, spatial sections with positive or negative curvature that, you know, still comes with three killing vectors, but their algebra is modified from this case over here. So in this very simple case, then we have the killing vector in the direction of x, and when we look at geodesic motion in this universe. We would have some sort of quantity associated with that. In fact, we worked it out last time. And of course, we would have the other ones as well. There's one more. So that's pretty much all I wanted to say about killing vectors and symmetries. I can sort of just make a quick statement to the effect that you know, there are such things as killing tensors, which are more complicated versions of these things, which give rise to additional symmetries. And one famous property of Kerr spacetime is that it possesses this additional symmetry, which is not manifested by a killing vector, but is manifested instead by a killing tensor. There is a hidden symmetry that was identified by Carter that allows you to write down the geodesic equation in completely integrated form, which is, you know, something that people didn't expect, and it came to be understood that, you know, this has to do with that extra symmetry that was hidden and is manifested through a killing tensor. And, you know, mathematicians or applied mathematicians tend to also, you know, try to catalog and organize all of those symmetries that are not just associated with killing vectors but also with higher structures. So when later in the course we go, you know, we have looked at the Kerr spacetime, we may come back to that property. So any questions about that? Yep.
It's not the energy of anything, is it? Don't call it energy just because it's ordinary. Mechanics normally through mechanical systems.
Yeah. Very good question. Thank you very much for asking the question, because it's a very important one, and it's very important to understand what we mean by energy.
And that's often a problem in relativity. I mean, you use words loosely. And if you do that, we all do that. If you do that, though, they can be interpreted differently from what you had intended. And sometimes it's good to put all the fine print back into making statements. So this question about energy is very, very important. So let me take the opportunity to say something about that. So let's take the Schwarzschild spacetime just as a specific example. And suppose that, okay, I have my black hole over here, and suppose that I fall in from infinity following it to Dzik, and, you know, just falling toward the black hole. Suppose that I started out at infinity, you know, a really long time ago. Let's see, do I want to draw this in a space-time diagram instead? Maybe not. So this is the spatial diagram. So this is a free-falling observer. And let me focus on a piece of that trajectory in a space-time diagram, because I think more clearly in those terms. So suppose that this is a geodesic in space-time, to which we have a tangent vector, which is the forward velocity. And suppose we want to ask, you know, what is the energy of that particle that's falling toward the black hole? And any decent notion of energy we would come up with, it would be such that, well, presumably the particle is falling in, it's, you know, it's going faster as it falls in, it's going deeper in potential wells, so presumably something happens to the energy during the inward motion. So the energy would measure of the particle, if you would measure how fast it's moving. So I'll try to be a bit more clear in a second. So I want to distinguish two notions of energy. That's really what I'm getting at. There's the conserved energy, the one that we've talked about, and there's the energy that you would actually measure if you were to interact with the particle while it's falling in. Those are distinct notions of energy. And so the notion of conserved energy is useful because it's a conserved quantity, but to call it the energy is something that can be misleading because it doesn't correspond to the energy that any observer would measure if they were to interact with the particle, unless they interact with it at infinity. That's what I want to talk about. So suppose that this is the free-falling observer, and suppose that you're yourself an observer and you want to interact with the particle. So this is the particle, and instead of talking about its forward velocity, I'll talk about its forward momentum, which is what I get when I multiply mass, the forward velocity by mass. And we seem to have lost McMass here, but I don't know what to do about that. So we have the forward velocity of the particle, and what I want to introduce is an observer who will want to measure the energy of that particle, but the only way to do that is to actually make sure that the observer is meeting with the particle. So whenever you make a measurement in relativity, and whenever you make a measurement anyway, you have to be somewhere doing the measurement, and you can only measure something that's in your lab, which means that you have to produce an encounter between the particle and the observer if you want to make that measurement. So this is the observer. And the forward velocity of the observer, I'll call U observed. The first statement is that the energy of particle measured by the observer, I'll call it E observed, it's not going to be that energy that we worked out before. We can figure out what it is, but let me give you the statement. It's the contraction of the momentum of the particle with the velocity of the observer, with the minus sign thrown in to make sure that the sign works out in the end. How do I do that? Well, here's the reasoning. If I'm an observer, I can move in space-time. I'm free-falling in space-time. I'm observing the my own surroundings. But as far as I'm concerned, if I'm free-falling in a gravitational field, there's no gravity in my vicinity, right? So that's the principle of equivalence. If I'm free-falling in a gravitational field, if I'm free-falling in space-time, and I make local measurements of how things move, as the balls around, I'll see all of them moving on straight lines. And in my immediate vicinity, in my reference frame, there's no gravity. That's just saying that, you know, around my own neighborhood, while I'm free-falling in space-time, I can set up a coordinate system such that the metric is flat. And in fact, we'll come back to that later on. In my frame, I'm not moving except moving in a time direction. So I'm in a locally Lorentz frame in which I'm not moving, which means that the only component of my core velocity in my frame is the time component. In this frame, this only has the one component along the time direction, which means that the right-hand side works out to be in my frame minus P naught. But I'm working in reference frame in which the metric is flat, which means that minus P naught with the index down is plus P naught with the index up. So in the what's called the local Lorentz frame, U alpha observer in that specialized coordinate system only has a time component. P alpha, of course, is the momentum of the particle, so this will have components all over the place. But the point is that when I take the contraction, I pick out only the time component. So that in that coordinate system, this works out to be minus pt with the index down. But being in the local Lorentz frame, this is pt with the index up. And all of that is done in the context of special relativity, and the time component of the momentum vector in special relativity is what I would decently call the energy of the particle as measured by me. So that's locally measured energy, the one that would be meaningful to an observer. And here I worked it out in a specific frame, and this is what has allowed me to associate the scalar quantity to something measurable and meaningful and, you know, operational and all that stuff. Bottom line is that in a general coordinate system, or, you know, defining this as a proper scalar instead of a component of vector expressed in this frame, this is an appropriate scalar expression to describe something which has direct, you know, direct physical meaning and would be interpreted as the measured energy of the particle. And that will change as the particle falls in. And it will change depending also on the nature of the observer, because of course different observers would assign different energies to the same particle. That measured energy is different from the conserved energy that we worked out, but in fact, there's a connection between the two, because my observer could be at infinity and at rest at infinity. An observer at rest at infinity would be moving in the time direction along the symmetry of the Killing vector. So when I was talking about the time direction here, I was talking about local time measured by that moving observer. But if I do now everything at infinity, okay, there are spectres of amps that I've left out here. So this is really the energy per unit mass. And here, you know, this is the four velocity of the particle and the four velocity of the observer. Anyway, there's little factors like this that I've left out. But anyway, the point is that if I'm an observer at rest at infinity, my four velocity is aligned with the Killing vector, which means that this energy is not the energy that that observer would measure, but it's the energy that the observer at infinity would measure. And we call it the entity, and it has, you know, for that reason we call it the entity, and it has the virtue of being conserved in, as the particle propagates in. So I think that's part of the thing. So we have two notions of energy, one which is meaningful and operational, another one which is more mathematical, but is defined as such because it's a conserved quantity. They're distinguished, they're not the same, we have to distinguish them properly. But this still can be called energy, but, you know, if I were to describe it fully, I would say energy as measured by an observer at rest at infinity, which, by the way, is also conserved along the particle's motion. That's a long phrase that I cut short by just saying energy. Question?
You measured by a particle having the same trajectory that the fault particle. Isn't that also
a statement? The energy you mentioned, we could just work it out by applying this formula. So the so an energy that would be measured by an observer following the particle. So
so that potential energy would be the momentum of the particle multiplied by the velocity of the particle. This would be the mass times the velocity. The velocity is a normalized vector. So the energy you're talking about is the response energy of the particle. And that's not surprising, because if the particle moves with the observer, well, according to the observer, the particle isn't moving at all, so the only form of energy it does have is response energy.
And that's what you pick out here. Sorry, there's a minus sign here, but there's a plus sign there. So that's also a good notion of energy, but it's a little trivial because that's just, you know, the rest. All right, any questions or unclear aspects about? So, yes, I'll come back to you, but, you know, just it's very important to distinguish this notion of energy, which is conserved energy, is constant of the motion, with the more physically meaningful notion of energy, which is what you actually get when you actually measure the energy of a particle. And when we go back to the first space-time, as I told you we would later on, there can be a lot of confusion if you don't keep these terms straight. And I'll try to rethink of this, you know, and warn you when we go back to that topic. So you had a question?
Okay, so if you're at infinity and you're not moving, you're an observer at rest at infinity, you're moving along the direction of time only. But now I'm talking about time at infinity, which is the same time that I'm using to characterize the time interactions of the Schwarzschild So that time, the time measured by an observer at rest at infinity,
is the same time that I'm using to describe the metric. It's the time transfer, and it's along that time direction that the killing vector is pointing. So so that's why we have quality between those two vectors. The four velocity is directed for that observer. The four velocity is directed along the killing direction.
And if the identification of infinity is really proportionality, the energy being defined is probably the original energy, just the proper space, the proper metric.
Right.
But nothing to do with the mass of the test particle.
True.
So the minute you split up over the energy of the test particle, that's going to bring the mass.
Yep.
So it's going to be really a proportionality with an identification. It's two energies.
The energy you measure at infinity is that energy, is M.
Right.
If you just take that, you know it's conserved, and you have F. So F at infinity is equal to 1.
That's correct.
And T dot is equal to 1. And you said you're missing the M on that equation, on that E equation. You're missing it properly.
Okay, so here, I wasn't careful with the notation. Here I was defining the energy per unit max. If I wanted to get the actual energy, I would actually throw in the factor of 10 here to talk about the momentum of the particle.
But you define the energy originally as a conserved quantum because the result of the killing vector is in the space-time.
Right.
Space-time could be a vector in space, but it could be no test particle. Still a meaningful conserved quantum. But nothing to do with the mass of any.
Okay, so let's see. So I have a space-time, and then I have a test particle in it, and I want to define the energy of the test particle.
Fair enough, but you could also define a conserved quantity without giving the test particles at all.
To me, that if you're using a vector field, that would be sort of disassociated from the motion of from a particle.
The answer is well-defined independent of the existence of the particle.
Okay, so then you would have a sort of more abstract notion of energy, not connected to particles. I don't have a problem with that. As a physicist, I don't know what I would do with it, but I think that there's no problem here. Okay.
That's an energy associated with the structure of the space itself.
Right, so so I think it's certainly fair to say that you can associate those notions purely in terms of the space-time without thinking of them related to particles, because, you know, this is the property of the space-time. The geodesics of that space-time are completely, you know, internal properties that may or may not have anything to do with particles, It just so happens that test particles move along 2 GZ. So in my physical mind, I tend to associate particles 2 GZ. But, you know, I don't have to do that. In a more abstract sense, if we talk about spacetimes, there are vectors, there are 2 GZ vector fields, and associate an energy to that, talking to that as a physical energy.
So the usefulness of that energy, though, you're not going to look for it in, say, temporarily how a metric evolves or something like that?
Well, mostly, so I think the importance of the conserved quantities is when you actually try to solve for the geodesic motion of the observer. So if you remember your advanced mechanics course, you know, you have Lagrangian that has certain symmetries. For each symmetry, you have a conserved quantity, and that allows you to solve a mechanical problem. You use the symmetries to your advantage in doing that exactly the same way. So we can turn motion in charge field to a one-dimensional problem, motion in the radial direction, because motion in the time direction is handled by that, motion in the five direction is handled by that, because in theta direction is trivial, can take the preferred plane, and therefore the only dynamics is taking place in the radial sector. So it's just a way of really simplifying the problem. There are other advantages. For example, I can work this example through, but it's a very nice example where you could use this as a way to derive the Rechet formula. So if you, you know, for this example this afternoon, I think it's pretty cute, and I think it illustrates the methods that I've introduced right here. So for example,
I'll do it I can do it in the context of Schwarzschild or in the context of FRW, but the point is that, you could have, this observer could be emitting photons. The photons would be escaping out infinity. There would be the frequency of those photons would be measured by an observer at infinity. The photons would have conserved energy. I won't say more because I want to work it out, and I'll present it this afternoon. But you know, there are lots of places where those techniques play a useful role. So yeah, good question. So I think it's probably a good time to stop because, from here on, I want to sort of complete our sort of very quick tour of differential geometry. So I'll say a few more things this afternoon, go fairly quickly over some stuff, but I'll come back to that example. But before we quit, any other questions that arise here that would complete the discussion? So I think we can reconvene in the afternoon. And sorry about the sound at McMaster. Hopefully that will be solved this afternoon. We're going to be in the other room this afternoon, so we'll see how it goes there. So I'll see you then.